You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Summertime is here and mosquitoes are too. Just the other day, I was out in the garden painting. Watercolor is my new hobby to help me relax and unwind. But it wasn't relaxing at all because almost as soon as I sat down, I was getting eaten alive. Don't let mosquitoes bug you this summer. True Green Mosquito Defense eliminates biting mosquitoes from your yard within 24 hours of application. It's all backed by their mosquito-free guarantee. Get your first True Green Mosquito Defense application for just $39.95, or bundle your mosquito defense with a flea and tick service for just $20 more. Visit truegreen.com/kick. That's TRUGreen.com/kick. Restrictions may apply. And now, on with the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. A Saudi prince accused of ordering the murder of a journalist, a Russian plot to exert greater influence in the Middle East, could easily be the latest headlines in your morning news feed. But for number one best-selling author Daniel Silva, they're the stuff of high intrigue and inspiration for his latest spy thriller, The New Girl, the 19th novel in his wildly popular Gabriel Alon series. The exploits of his fictional Israeli spy often mirror the geopolitics of the moment, and it's not surprising given Daniel Silva's background. A former journalist for United Press International and CNN, Daniel Silva closely follows international affairs, and oftentimes, when world events change, his stories have to change too. As Daniel reveals on today's podcast, he was 250 pages into writing his latest novel when the murder of Jamal Khashoggi happened, and he had to toss it out and go right back to square one. He discusses the similarities and differences between his fictional Saudi prince and the brutal Mohammed bin Salman, why he believes Russia may have had something to do with President Trump's decision to give him a pass on the Khashoggi murder, and his disappointment that bin Salman hasn't turned out to be the reformer that he once promised. Daniel recalls meeting his wife and fellow journalist Jamie Gangel during the Iran-Iraq War, working at CNN in the early days of 24-hour news, and being there on the night when the network brought Operation Desert Storm into America's living rooms. Daniel reveals why he decided to give his fictional spy the cover of being an art restorer, why he initially didn't think the character would last more than one book, and why he still writes all of his novels the old-fashioned way, with a legal pad and a number two pencil. Coming up with number one best-selling author Daniel Silva in just a moment. Daniel Silva is an award-winning number one New York Times best-selling author who has been called his generation's finest writer of international intrigue and one of the greatest American spy novelists ever. His books are critically acclaimed bestsellers all around the world and have been translated into 30 different languages. He's best known for his long-running thriller series starring spy and art restorer Gabriel Alon, and now his latest addition to the series just hit the shelves. It's titled The New Girl, and today he joins me on the podcast to talk about it. Daniel, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, I hope I have this right, but I think The New Girl is the 19th book in the Gabriel Alone series. Gabriel Alone has now become an iconic character, but I understand that when you first wrote him, you only intended it to be a one-off book, not a whole series. Did you ever imagine that he would have become as successful as he has? And what do you think is the secret to his popularity?
You know, when I was working on the early drafts and notes of that first book, he wasn't even going to be the primary character in this novel. He was more of a second-tier character.
Huh.
And the more I wrote him, the more that I explored this compelling other side to his character, that he was his cover job was that he was an art restorer. He just really took over that first book.
Mm-hmm.
I just fell in love with him. But when I finished that novel, I gave no thought whatsoever to continuing with him. And I really had to be talked into writing a second Gabriel Alone novel by my publisher at the time, the great Phyllis Grant. And I was very skeptical about whether it could succeed and work in a truly mass market way. I thought there was too much anti-Israeli sentiment in the world, too much anti-Semitism, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And Phyllis was very confident that that was not the case. Loved the character. She said, write it. It's going to work. I wrote the second Gabriel Alone book, and it sold much better than the first Gabriel Alone book. And it seems remarkable to me to think about this, but The Confessor, which is the third Gabriel Alone book, and it's on numerous lists of greatest thrillers of all time. When I first made the initial notes and sketches on that, it was not supposed to be a Gabriel Alone book. I actually had to be talked into turning that into a Gabriel Alone book. And when I finished that book, I realized that I probably had a successful series on my hand and have been writing him ever since.
Yeah, successful indeed. And you mentioned that he kind of has one foot in Israeli intelligence and one foot in the art world. When you first created this character, did you know much about the art world?
You know what? I took the odd art history course in college, did some drawing and painting myself, love art. One of those people that sort of go weak in the knees in front of a beautiful painting. One thing that I knew absolutely nothing about was the craft of art restoration or conservation. And I was very fortunate in that one of my closest friends really is one of the world's finest art restorers. And I pulled him aside one evening at a dinner party in Georgetown. I said, David, I have this crazy idea. I'd like to take a Israeli assassin and turn him into an Italian art restorer. Can you help me? And he said, sure, no problem. And I went into the conservation lab at the National Gallery the very next day and watched restorers while they went about their work and was just entranced by what I saw.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that I watched them and the more that I learned about restoration, the more it seemed to me that it had a great deal in common with the craft of assassination.
Interesting.
And in fact, I structured that very first Gabriel Alone novel as though the operation that he was involved in was actually a restoration. And restoration has, you know, played a prominent role in the series ever since. And not just restoration of paintings, but restoration of people, restoration of situations.
Huh.
Tikkun Olam, repair of the world. It's an important spine of the entire series. And in the course of writing these now 19 books, Gabriel Alone has become a rather prominent figure within the restoration community. And I know that I have am very well read among the fraternity of art restorers.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, I go to, you know, special lengths to make sure that the craft of restoration is accurately represented as possible within the pages of the stories.
Yeah, and I'm very interested in this idea of art restoration as sort of a metaphor, because he is someone who kind of operates in a lot of gray areas in the world and at times is dealing with people that he has hopes of restoring or redeeming. And this latest book is a good example. The New Girl centers around a Saudi prince named Khalid bin Mohammed, who is accused of ordering a murder of a journalist. Well, that sounds familiar. Will readers recognize that
before?
Yeah.
Where have I heard that before? Well, as I point out in the foreword of the novel, I started working in August on a rather different novel, and that's putting it mildly. I've wanted to write a novel featuring someone like Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, for a couple of years now. I've watched his rise very, very carefully. And not only about, you know, a reforming Saudi prince, not just that, but also about this burgeoning secret relationship between the Israelis and the Saudis. It's incredibly important. It's one of the great underreported and understood stories of the Middle East right now. Mm-hmm. And in August of last year, I started working on that novel. And in early October, I saw the first little report that Jamal Khashoggi, a contributing columnist for the Washington Post and an important Saudi dissident, was missing. Within a few days, we learned that he had been brutally murdered in Istanbul. And a few days after that, we learned that Mohammed bin Salman had almost certainly given the order for that murder to be carried out. And I took the 250 pages that I had written and tossed them in the trash can and started over. Because what I had written and my character just didn't match up. Mm-hmm. It was too out of sync with what was going on in the real world. And that's happened to me a couple of times.
Yeah.
I write pretty close to the edge in terms of what's going on real world. Gabriel Alon exists in a parallel universe that is roughly in sync with the real world. What I had written just didn't hold up anymore.
Yeah.
Didn't hold up. So I had to start over.
Wow. Now, how often does it happen to that extent where you start a book with one thing in mind and then world events change the whole trajectory of a story and you have to go completely back to the drawing
this
board?
This is the most glaring example of that. But a few years ago, I wrote a book that also featured a prominent Saudi character. And I was setting it against the backdrop of the Arab Spring, and it day by day trying to keep pace with events.
Yeah.
In that really dramatic year, I had written Osama bin Laden was not a character in that novel, but he was very much alive and well in that novel and referenced in that novel. And as I was in final galleys in May of that year, we killed Osama bin Laden, and I had to quickly rewrite all the passages.
Oh, wow.
Modern publishing and printing techniques are such that I finished the last pass galleys on this novel June 1st.
Wow.
And you know, 5 weeks later, the book is finished and in bookstores. So I was able to correct that. So it's happened a couple of times.
Yeah.
The Black Widow wrote a scene that exactly mirrored the attacks of November 2015. The similarities were so shocking that I almost considered, I did consider setting that book aside. I decided to finish that novel. So it's happened a few times.
Yeah. Such are the perils of writing fiction that so closely parallels geopolitics, I guess. As a former journalist yourself, who's also married to a journalist, did the Khashoggi murder hit you especially hard?
Of course. And I have lots of friends that work for the Washington Post. I have friends who are in the administration, in Congress. So I've had a ringside seat as we've been wrestling, our government, on how to respond to this. And President Trump has a clear vision of how he thinks we should respond to it. And I think there's a growing bipartisan consensus on Capitol Hill that the response should go in a different direction. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's too strong to say that I think that our relationship with Saudi Arabia is kind of hanging by a thread right now.
Yeah.
And there's just a growing consensus, both parties, that this murder was just so reckless and so outrageous and so gruesome and inhuman that there has to be a very, very strong response.
Yeah.
You know, in a perfect world, we would tell the Saudis, find someone else to be your king. And then we would issue arrest warrants and extradition requests for the people responsible. And we would sanction senior members of the Saudi government, including a full and complete travel ban on members of the royal family, including MBS, to the United States. But then what? You know, unfortunately, for better or worse, this is a historic and important relationship. We need the Saudis right now in the Persian Gulf, particularly with the situation with Iran as it is. And I guess that, like Gabriel Alon, I believe that we should try to help MBS become the reformer that he promised he would be. That doesn't mean we should let him get away with murder and that there shouldn't be very strong sanctions and a very clear and unequivocal response. But I don't think that we can afford right now to absolutely flush our relationship with the Saudis. I think that would be a mistake.
Well, your Saudi prince aspires to be a reformer, and perhaps toward the end, maybe there's some hope for him. Who knows?
Most definitely. I think I want to say draw a clear distinction between my character, Khalid bin Mohammed, and MBS. He's very different. They're a very different person, and the circumstances surrounding the murder of a dissident Saudi journalist that take place in The New Girl are incredibly different than what happened in real life.
Right. But there were still hopes that MBS was going to be a reformer initially. Do you think those hopes have been dashed?
Oh, not hope. I mean, he promised us he was going to be a reformer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it was, and in my opinion, it was, you know, to justify upending the traditional line of succession and appointing a 33-year-old to be the crown prince and de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is big fundamental change to the line of succession and the way business was conducted inside the House of Saud. I have to say that I always had some skepticism about it. And unfortunately, I was proven right. Had some just not arguments, but long discussions with people I really, really respect who were completely committed to MBS, thought he was the real thing, thought he was going to fundamentally change the relationship between the Arab world, the Sunni Arab world, and Israel, and were really committed to the idea that he was a reformer. And I was just always skeptical about that. Mm-hmm. And I think that I was proven right.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's hard because when I look at the leaders in the region who've tried to modernize and prevent their countries from turning toward radical Islam, most of the time, they're not guys like King Hussein of Jordan. They're guys like Saddam Hussein, Hosni Mubarak, Gaddafi, Assad, with
tough
ISIS
guys
and other radical groups out there just waiting to fill the power vacuum. How does a leader modernize and reform and yet, for lack of a better term, keep the crazies under control without resorting to brutal oppression? I mean, isn't that the only thing that Islamists understand?
The experience of the Arab Spring and, you know, having, in effect, the Muslim Brotherhood come to power in Egypt and to have ISIS rise in the vacuum of post Arab Spring Syria. Lots of people lost faith in the idea of reforming political reform in the Arab world, Arab democracy, and you know, justifying the brutal crackdown on pro democracy groups in Egypt and elsewhere. And I have to say, I just think that that's generally short-sighted. I think there's going to be another Arab Spring. Who knows if it'll happen in the springtime this time. But I think there's going to be another. It might not be region-wide like it was last time, but it's only a matter of time before this huge demographic bulge of young people in that region rise up again and demand to have more say over their daily lives and to have decent governance. And you know, after we were all chastened and unsettled and rattled by how the Arab Spring turned out, we have sort of agreed to this Faustian bargain to let the strong men restore order and restore Syria to its restore the borders of the old Syria largely, bring order to Egypt again. And, you know, I have to say that, to reiterate, I think ultimately we're going to regret that decision. I think that it's only a matter of time before the region starts to stir again. There must be political reform in the region. Mm-hmm. There must be give people the right to free speech, freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, to be able to read whatever they want to read without fear of the secret police knocking on their door.
Sure.
I don't know how long this status quo can persist. And so we need someone in Saudi Arabia to help bring that about. Mm. And Mohammed bin Salman promised that he was that person, not necessarily democracy, but to be more enlightened, to bring women into the workforce, to unshackle women in Saudi Arabia, to turn Saudi Arabia into a normal country. We're not asking for Jeffersonian democracy, but we're asking for something decent.
Yeah.
And it's not happening.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that the U.S. places too much value on Saudi Arabia's influence as a regional counterweight to Iran? Or is it just a situation where the enemy of my enemy is my friend and that's just the way it goes?
No, look, this relationship began at the end of World War II, meeting between Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Ibn Saud on Bitter Lake in Egypt. It is historic. It is deep. It is wide. It is intelligence, military, financial, energy. I mean, it is just an important relationship. But, you know, one of the things I'm hearing from my sources, look, the Saudis are pouring millions and millions of dollars into their Washington lobbyists, you know, trying to clean up this mess and move on from it. And one of the things that the Saudis are saying through these channels, they're letting people in Washington know that, yes, they want the relationship to normalize and get back to a sort of a pre-Khashoggi footing, but they're also really not interested in being pushed around. Mm-hmm. And they're sending clear signals that, look, we want to normalize. We want to get the relationship back on secure footing again, but we don't. We're done being apologizing and being pushed around on this. And if you're not interested in having us as your friends, we're going to find friends elsewhere. And once upon a time, that would have been a hollow threat, but I don't think it is anymore. And I think that long-term trends, or in terms of our own energy production, about our desire to sort of put the Middle East and all of its problems in our rearview mirror, I think long-term trends are saying, pushing Saudi Arabia away from us, okay? Mm-hmm. And it is only natural that Saudi Arabia is going to align more closely with the Chinese and the Russians. It's happening already before our very eyes. And, you know, I'm not sure that at this point we want to serve as an accelerant on that process. And I think that the Middle East is going to be a very different place, and I'm not sure it's going to be a better place when Russia and China are the two hegemons rather than the United States.
Right. And your book, The New Girl, actually deals with Russia's growing influence in the region.
Yep.
Do you think that looming presence of Russia in the Middle East is one of the reasons why Trump decided to, let's be honest, essentially give MBS a pass on the Khashoggi murder?
I do indeed. Hmm. I do indeed. And it was very interesting. Two of the little sidelights of the whole affair was the famous high five in Buenos Aires.
Right.
You know, there's the picture. That's the new world order, the age of impunity, as David Miliband, the former British foreign secretary, refers to it. Two of the most powerful, richest men in the world high-fiving each other and saying, ha, we can get away with murder. We can do anything we want, and no one can do a damn thing about it.
Yeah.
And that's pretty scary. I'm afraid that's the new world order. That's the post-American age right there.
Wow.
And look, I don't think we necessarily want to, as I said before, you know, accelerate that by pushing Saudi Arabia into the arms of Russia. And, you know, one of the when we were really, when the condemnations were really raining down on MBS in the fall, there was an interesting event where Putin stood up and said, look, he's the next king. Stay out of Saudi Arabia's affairs, internal affairs. This is none of your business. How fascinating was that?
Yeah.
Look, I think that MBS is already tilting towards Russia a little bit. He's not alone. Sisi of Egypt has been to Moscow 4 times. More than he's visited the United States. Benjamin Netanyahu has also been to Russia 4 times to meet with Putin. Russia is a growing power in the Middle East, and you know, the regional players have taken notice of that and are hedging their bets.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you about your character, Gabriel Allon's relationship with Saudi Arabia. Here he is. He's a pretty principled man. He's an Israeli. And yet, the events kick off, and he ends up deciding to help out a Saudi prince who's accused of ordering the murder of a journalist.
Yep.
Why does Gabriel decide to help him, and how does he rationalize that?
Well, you know, once upon a time, he would have told the Saudi prince to take care of his own problems. But he is now the chief of Israeli intelligence, which means he is one of the most important players in the Middle East. There's no other way to say that the director of the Mossad is a vital and important actor in Middle East affairs. And he is making a cold realpolitik calculation that this person, faults and all, is better than the alternative. And he's also making a cold calculation that if I help this guy, I'm going to, as we say in the intelligence business, own him. He's going to owe me a huge favor, and I'm going to be able to call that debt in one day. But ultimately...
And that always works out so well, doesn't it?
Yeah. Ultimately, Gabriel Allon, the restorer, is going to make an attempt to fix what went wrong and turn the fictitious character, Khalid bin Mohammed, into the person that he promised to be. And that is what I think that we really need to be doing when it comes to Saudi Arabia. We cannot give him a blank check to kill without any consequences. To behave recklessly in the region without any consequences. And our policy should be to help him become the person that he promised to be the leader that he promised to be. That should be the goal of American policy, in my humble opinion.
And it's such a curious thing, this strong relationship between Israel and the Saudis, not just in the book, but in real life. What do you think motivates that? Is it simply that Saudi Arabia is the most rational actor in the region, aside from Israel? and is it worth it?
It is a direct outgrowth of the Iran nuclear agreement reached by the Obama administration and the Iranians, which the Trump administration withdrew from as promised. And a fear or a belief or a realization, as I said earlier, that the United States was withdrawing slowly but surely from the region. I hesitate to use the word in decline, but we were recalibrating. And Israel is the regional superpower. It's an economic superpower. It has incredible technology. It is an intelligence superpower. It's a military superpower. And why wouldn't you want to be have a relationship with a country like that that's right across the border? And it's been an important relationship for Israel, and it makes perfect sense that the head of Israeli intelligence would help the crown prince in a situation like I created for Gabriel Alon.
Now, I have to ask you about your past life. Prior to writing novels, you were actually a journalist who worked for UPI and CNN. How much does that previous career in news inform your fiction?
Tremendously. I mean, I worked in the Middle East. I lived in Cairo. I lived in Bahrain. I have been a student of the region. I witnessed the birth of Islamic extremism firsthand, have been followed the rise and fall of Al-Qaeda. I just am fascinated by the region, its politics, its people, its history, its languages, its cuisine. I love the Middle East. It's not surprising that I ended up writing a series based largely there.
Yeah, and I understand that you actually met your wife, Jamie Gangle, while you were both in the Middle East covering the Iran-Iraq war. Is that the kind of setting conducive to a romance?
Of course it is. Yeah, Jamie, I was living in Bahrain. She came over on a temporary assignment. And we had a whirlwind romance and were married 8 months later.
And after you and Jamie married, you moved back to D.C. and joined CNN. You were there right around the time of Desert Storm in the early 90s when CNN was just really starting to take off. I have to think that must have been a very exciting time to be there. Do you have any great stories from those days? That was the beginning of 24-hour news.
I was in the control room when the war began. So for the first few hours of Desert Storm, when the air war began, I was actually the producer of those hours, the Washington producer.
Wow.
And the other really wonderful thing that happened for me when I was at CNN during that time was I was able to interact with all of the major players during the Oslo signing week. Oslo
Peace
Accord. So I got to spend a lot of time with everybody on both sides. And that was just a fascinating period. But look, I enjoyed my time as a journalist, but I have to confess that I became a journalist so I could become a novelist.
Oh, really? That was always the plan.
That was always the plan, and I thought journalism was the best way to get there, that I thought it would give me good training in the art of storytelling, that it would provide me experiences that I could draw upon later, and all that turned out to be the case.
Now, what is your writing process like? Do you have a pretty disciplined routine when you're writing a novel?
Yeah, monastic. I get up very early in the morning. I still wake up. I'm not a big sleeper. So usually I'm awake by about 4:30 or 5. I quickly read the papers on my phone while I drink a couple of cups of coffee. And then I get dressed and I get to work. And early on in the writing year, I try not to work too many hours in a day. And then right around December 1st, that's where I really begin to feel the deadline pressure. And I usually write about 8 to 10 hours a day straight. I can't stand days off. I find them to be very disruptive. I guess the other couple of interesting things about my work habits are that I don't outline my novels. No, I do not produce detailed outlines. And I still write largely in longhand, which is...
That's right, on pads, right?
Yeah, I write in longhand.
Wow.
And...
Doesn't that make it hard to edit your work, though?
No, I will write in longhand, and then I'll take those pages over to the computer and type them in and edit them on the computer.
Oh, okay.
I'm not completely crazy. I do not hand in my work in longhand.
Yeah, interesting. Well, then before we go, I just have to ask, do you have a secret for treating hand cramps?
I don't get them.
You don't?
And it helps out on book tour because I can sit and sign for hours without
12 hours of writing with a pencil and pad.
Yeah, my right hand's in pretty good shape.
No kidding. Once again, the book is called The New Girl. I enjoyed it, and I hope that other people will check it out. I'm sure they will. Daniel, thanks so much for talking to me.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. A lot of fun.
Thanks again to Daniel Silva for coming on the show. Order his latest thrilling novel, The New Girl, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Visit his website at danielsilvabooks.com and follow him on Twitter at @DanielSilvaBook. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @KickassNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.